From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Coming up, General Motors announces that it will close plants that make SUVs, and it may scrap the Hummer.
First, in South Dakota and Montana today, the long primary season finally does end. There are conflicting statements reported from the campaign of Senator Clinton about her plans.
The campaign chair says she will not concede, but an early report from the Associated Press quotes her senior campaign official saying the senator would acknowledge that Senator Obama will get the number of delegates he needs for the nomination. The Clinton campaign, again, refutes that report.
John Dickerson, chief political writer for Slate.com. John, is this a careful parsing of language or what?
Yes, it's a careful parsing of language. It's also language coming out in the middle of negotiations between the two campaigns, negotiations that are going on both in real time and also in the press. And it's also a sign of confusion. One of the big things that's up in the air is the question of, does Barack Obama have the actual numbers? And that will push Senator Clinton, I think, one way or the other, if by the time she's giving her speech, he's gotten over that important threshold number, and we'll just have to see if that happens.
This number is 2,118. That's the number of total delegates that you will need now to win the nomination in the Democratic Party. That's the number.
That's exactly right. And Obama will get to that number. It's just a question of whether he gets to it tonight. You know, part of this is the parsing is about what Senator Clinton will say in her speech tonight after these primary results come in. And if by that hour the magical number has been reached, that will affect the speech in one way. If that magical number is not reached until, say, tomorrow after a few more superdelegates come out, then that changes what Clinton may be forced to say when she speaks tonight.
John, we do know that Senator Clinton does have plans for this big event in New York tonight, the speech you've referred to. She's called in supporters and big donors from all around the country, invited them to come to this event. There are reports that word has gone out to staff that they have one more week left, and then the campaign is not going to be paying them any longer. What are they waiting for?
Well, they are waiting. Both sides are waiting. As you point out, it's over. Now the question is just how to manage the end. And there are a couple of constituencies here. One, Clinton wants to have maybe some of her debts paid off. There are a lot of rumors going around. So there's a question of her debts. There's also the question of her supporters. Some of the African-American supporters have taken a lot of flack for supporting her and not Barack Obama. Then there's the question of the vice presidency. Will she be offered it? Will they at least have a conversation about it? And then there are all kinds of other issues, including will Barack Obama say anything perhaps to tamp down or absolve Bill Clinton of some of the things he said that have been perceived by some people to have a kind of racial tinge to them. Lots of issues to be played out there. Barack Obama doesn't want to force Clinton's hand too much. He knows it's over. He knows he's got the numbers. And in fact, one of the ways he'll be evaluated by her supporters, many of whom have raised the charge of sexism, is how he handles her exit from the race. Is he sufficiently gracious? Does he begin this party healing process that everybody in the Democratic Party anyway, is desperate to have begin?
Senator Obama is holding a rally in St. Paul, Minnesota tonight. That's where he's going to be, not in Montana or South Dakota, but St. Paul, Minnesota. What is the point of that?
Well, I'm actually with Senator Obama in Chicago right now. He's flying at the end of the day to Minnesota. That's where the Republicans will hold their convention. Minnesota is a swing state, and Obama is going there to basically kick off his general election campaign. He's had lots of little mini kickoffs for the last several weeks. He's really been in a fight with John McCain, much more so than Hillary Clinton. But this is an attempt for him to begin telling the story that will consume us for the rest of the election year as we go into the general election. So he's going there, and he'll talk about bringing people together. He'll talk about, he's in a swing state, so he wants to be there to kind of fight for that state that will be important in the battleground map for the general election. And he wants to set the themes on his own terms for that general election battle with John McCain.
John Dickerson from Slate.com with Senator Obama on his way to Minnesota. John, thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
One of New York State's last undecided superdelegates has decided. She is Irene Stein of Ithaca, New York, and she's chairwoman of the Tompkins County Democratic Committee. She's here now. And welcome to the program, Ms. Stein. Who are you backing?
I'm backing Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. I'm convinced, having thought this through very carefully and watched every kind and source of information that I could think of, that she is the candidate that is strongest against the Republican candidate, John McCain.
Why did you wait until now?
Two different kinds of reasons. One, I take my responsibility as a superdelegate very seriously, and that responsibility is to act according to my judgment as to what would be best for the Democratic Party and the nation. Second, it was a very difficult situation for me personally because Tompkins County, my county, is the only county in New York State where a majority of the voters supported Senator Obama in the primary. So I take that very seriously. Secondly, I was elected to the DNC, which in turn allowed me to be a superdelegate, and I was elected by the State Democratic Committee, which is heavily supportive of Hillary Clinton. I have a lot of conflicting pressures on me. I would watch the data very, very carefully, and I came to the conclusion that we will win with Senator Obama if he is our candidate. Hillary Clinton is substantially stronger when you look at the analysis that shows how they fare in each state according to that state's electoral college votes. Because as you know, the popular vote does not elect a president. We found that out, unfortunately, at the beginning of the Bush years, in my opinion. The electoral college vote does. And Hillary Clinton is very strong, and she easily beats McCain, and this has been consistent. Putting that hard data together with my judgment and my gut based on about 30 years in political life, 30 years of interacting with people in politics, I just felt that Hillary Clinton is the much stronger candidate.
But do you worry that your vote now may be a little too little too late, that Barack Obama...
I did not feel ready to make a vote earlier, and I don't know if I would have altered anything by making a vote earlier.
How do you feel, though, about going against the wishes of your constituents, the voters in your county who went for Barack Obama?
I'm not happy about it. But I was not elected by them to make this particular judgment, and I've explained it to them to the best of my ability, and I hope and believe that they respect my goodwill, and I think they fully understand that no one will work harder than I to elect the Democratic candidate, no matter who that person is.
Ms. Stein, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
That's Irene Stein of Ithaca, New York, a newly announced superdelegate for Hillary Clinton.
Seattle lawyer and Democratic superdelegate David McDonald was on the party's rules committee that met over the weekend to settle the difficult issue of the errant Michigan and Florida primaries. He stayed undeclared through that process and now says he will vote for Senator Obama. David McDonald, we spoke on Friday. Welcome back. How long have you known that Senator Obama is your candidate?
Oh, I would say about 18, 19 hours.
Really? You only just made up your mind, really, truly?
Yeah.
I know that you felt that you shouldn't say where you were before this Rules Committee meeting over the weekend, but did you really have some instinct of where you were going?
No, but what I had is from watching that either one of them could win the general election. And just to step back a bit on the process, I really was doing my best to simply not get attached to either candidate. But once the Rules Committee was over, I had a day to sightsee in D.C. and took it rather than watching news that day, and had a six-hour plane flight with no cell phone interruptions and, unfortunately, or fortunately, I suppose, no movies on the plane that I hadn't seen, and a night's sleep, and then woke up and thought, well, you know, I need to think about this morning in started thinking about it, but I needed some free time, frankly. I mean, I kept coming back to the fact that Obama started with a 50-state strategy and was willing to go early into relatively tough territory where we, for the last number of years, have not really been contesting seats, and dig out Democrats and organize them. That, coupled with the energy level that I was seeing in Obama's supporters, were really kind of the tipping factors.
What do you think of the process this year? Because Senator Obama does come to the end of this, well, as John Dickerson writes at Slate.com, not sprinting across the finish line. I mean, it's a difficult end for him.
it is a difficult end, but what he gains from it is he is tested. A president's got to be able to deal with surprises and adversity. I mean, let's face it, that job does not go according to script. So he's gotten out of this extended campaign something he never would have gotten if everybody folded up on February 15th.
You've said that you're confident either candidate can win the general election.
Yes.
But I wonder, what is your assessment of Senator McCain as a candidate? And what does your party have to do in order to win against him?
I'd say the main thing we have to do to win against McCain is remind people that he's not all that different than George Bush. And I don't think the public wants to continue the Bush agenda.
But if the public has an idea of Senator McCain, it is as someone who often disagrees with his party leadership and with the White House. He's been a difficult ally for the Bush White House for years.
My memory is that he was a more difficult ally for them before the 2000 race for president than after, and that afterwards, when he could begin to see he might run again, he seems to have been far more supportive of Bush. And I think it's the last 8 years, the actual Bush tenure, that we need to look at.
What role would you like Senator Clinton to play now?
I would like her to put in the same tenacity into getting a White House administration that's Democratic and a broad mandate from the public to carry across an agenda that both houses of Congress will support. And I think from the years I've known her, that's what she wants to do, too. I mean, she probably wants a night's sleep or something, but I think that's where she is, too.
David McDonald, superdelegate from Seattle and now declared supporter of Senator Obama for that nomination. David, thank you.
Thanks.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. The Greatest Manhunt of World War II, part of the subtitle of a new book that tells the unbelievable, true story of a GI on the run in the jungles of Burma. Sex, drugs, murder, race, the story keeps unfolding to a very dark end. We know Brendan Koerner from Slate.com. Now the Hell Will Start is his first book. Brendan, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me, Alex.
So this is the story of a man named Herman Perry. Who was he?
He was a pretty ordinary guy. He was a young African-American meat cutter from Washington, D.C., who was drafted into the Army in 1942, shipped off to the Indo-Burmese border region to work on the Lido Road, which was a military highway that was being built from northeast India across northern Burma and then linking up the old Burma Road at China to keep nationalist China supplied during the war.
That was a huge project and undertaking, and one that was extremely difficult. You write about the circumstances of this place, just brutal. Leeches, disease, terrible heat, humidity, rain, mud, and the headhunters.
And the headhunters, these were the Naga. This is an ethnic group, a multi-tribal ethnic group that lives up and down the Indo-Burmese border in the hills there. And this was a tribe renowned and feared for its practice of headhunting. It really was the linchpin of their society at the time.
So these people are all over the hills, also tigers, snakes, a lot of dangerous things. But maybe the worst part of daily life for the soldiers like Herman Perry, this is an all-black kind of construction brigade that he's in, are these racist white officers. I mean, they have a very difficult time there.
Yeah, this is a segregated army during World War II, you have to keep in mind. Many, many black soldiers were consigned to labor battalions because the War Department really bought into the racial science of the day, thinking that black soldiers weren't necessarily fit for combat. So most black soldiers were consigned to these kind of menial, manual labor chores and often to the worst assignments, the Lido Road being one of them.
Well, Herman Perry snaps after months and months and months working on this road, very bad conditions. He's being maybe harassed or maybe disciplined by a white lieutenant. And Herman Perry shoots him, kills him, and runs for the forest.
Yeah, that's right. The other factor in this is that he'd also been coming off an all-night opium bender, and that's why he'd missed the call of revelry in the morning. And so he'd been placed under arrest, actually, and he'd been to the stockade once before and had a very horrific experience there. They used very extreme punishments on the inmates in the stockade in India. So when he learned that he was going to be under arrest once more and heading back to the stockade, he just absolutely snapped and ends up shooting this white lieutenant who was unarmed, I should add, to death on the Lido Road.
So he goes into the forest. He's just got the clothes that he's wearing, nothing else. And what happens?
Well, first he actually wanders back into camp. After 3 days, he kind of goes through a dissociative episode and kind of forgets what happens. He goes back to camp as if nothing had happened, and he learns, much to his horror, that he had killed this white lieutenant and there was a 1,000 rupee price on his head. He has a rifle with him, and his friends give him a few tins of food, and he starts running. But he realizes pretty early on during his flight that he has to find a place to settle down permanently or he'll never make it in the jungle. And one day he's walking along a stream up in the Patkai Mountains, and he sees the glimpse of this peaked longhouse with palm fronds, and he starts walking towards it. And this is the village where he kind of reinvents himself as a member of the Naga tribe.
How is it that this black American GI on the run and really being pursued by the army, how is he able to ingratiate himself with a tribe of headhunters living in this remote village in the mountains of Burma?
On the most basic level, bribery. He actually enlisted the aid of some fellow sympathetic soldiers, African-American soldiers, who stole rations for him, especially a tinned fruit cocktail. And the Nagas loved this, not just for the food, but also for the tin. They didn't really have lightweight metals. He also had an M1 rifle. The Nagas just had spears and swords, and so the rifle came in very handy for hunting. But I think the other aspect is just his personality. I interviewed his sister, and the thing that came up again and again about Herman is just he was a very, very charming man. He really had the gift of gab. And he picked up some of the tribal language while working on the road, so he really used that to his advantage in becoming a member of this tribe.
And Herman stays on in this village. He meets the daughter of the, I guess, village or clan chief, mm-hmm. and they fall in love, and he marries her. They have a child. I mean, I'm thinking, no, Brendan's got to be making this up, right? I mean, what a story.
Yeah, it's such a story, and there were many times in researching it, I thought, I'm going to hit a brick wall here. It can't really get any more incredible. And if it does become more incredible, there's no way I can verify that these things actually happened. But every time I surprised myself and found a way to fact-check myself and to verify that these events actually took place, and a lot of that is actually just an official army documentation from his court-martial.
He was court-martialed. This manhunt, the great manhunt, did succeed at last. He was caught. He was tried. He was sentenced to death for the murder of this lieutenant. And then he manages to escape.
Yeah, he escapes from death row in India. He actually lucked out in that the appeals process was held up by a variety of kind of quirks of fortune. So it took a few months for his death sentence to be approved by the military brass. And during that time, he was able to plot his escape.
Brendan, we'll stop there because I don't want to give away the ending. But I do want to know this. How do you get this information? Because none of the really central characters here are still alive.
There were many people involved in the drama who are still alive. I managed to track down the prosecutor involved in the court-martial, a military policeman who actually shot Perry during one of these phases of the manhunt. And at the time, this was a really, really big story out there in India and Burma. There actually is a lot of documentation of what occurred. It just took a lot of elbow grease to find it.
You couldn't interview Herman Perry. The accounts of what he did and why he did it, they're drawn from documents and accounts from that time. Were you ever able to figure it out? What did happen with him?
I really think that the story is both more complex and more simple than I think a lot of people would assume. On a very basic level, he was a jungle freakout. There were a lot of them. He experienced what we now call PTSD. He was traumatized. He was a psychiatric casualty. And that led to the tragic circumstances that ended in Lieutenant Harold Cady's murder. So I think that's part of it. But also, you have to realize that he became a folk hero to a lot of people along the road, especially African-American soldiers. So there was a lot of mythology that grew up around this decidedly ordinary guy caught up in extraordinary circumstances.
Brendan Koerner. His new book is Now the Hell Will Start. It's the story of Herman Perry and the greatest manhunt of World War II. Brendan, thank you.
Thanks a million, Alex.
You can find a link to a slideshow about Private Herman Perry and the Burma Road at our website, npr.org. NPR's Day to Day continues.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. Coming up, you think our gas prices are bad? Will you hear from drivers in Britain?
High gas prices, that is the main reason GM gave for closing four of its assembly plants, plants that make big trucks and SUVs. Some 10,000 workers could lose their jobs over the next few years. Chief Executive Rick Wagoner says this is a response to a, quote, permanent shift by Americans who are buying fewer gas guzzlers. Even the Hummer could be on the chopping block. Joining me now to talk about this is Jean Jennings. She's the president and editor-in-chief of Automobile Magazine. Jean, this seems to be pretty big news that Rick Wagoner is saying that this is a permanent shift away from SUVs and big trucks.
It's pretty huge news considering that's the bread and butter vehicle, or was the bread and butter vehicle for so many years for the Detroit carmakers.
So what does this mean, that this is the end of these kinds of automobiles?
No, it doesn't mean it's the end. It means that, you know, there will be still purpose-built vehicles. There are still contractors out there who need pickup trucks, and they will still build these vehicles. It just really cuts out the dilettantes. You will no longer see 400,000 pickup trucks sold in a year. And it means that we will see small trucks, smaller, more fuel-efficient crossover vehicles. It won't be the end of vehicles that will hold six or seven or eight people. It won't be the end of vehicles that will be able to pull boats or trailers or carry loads. It just means you'll see more fuel-efficient and smaller versions of those vehicles.
So what will we not be seeing anymore? Of which brands are going away forever?
I would expect that Hummer is really seriously on the block because there is no reason for that vehicle. It is a toy, and in relative terms, they use a lot of gas. I would hate to just predict the demise of actual brands, but there is no doubt that the price of fuel is going to stay high. Once China turned from an oil exporting to an oil importing nation, that was our signal that the Third World was ready to start using fossil fuels. That party's over. It is just over. So we are now in a rush to create more fuel efficient vehicles, to use more alternative technologies. And this year we will see a humongous jump in small passenger car vehicles being sold instead of trucks and SUVs.
Well, how quickly can GM make this turnaround?
Well, you know, they're on the move. I mean, they can make the move very quickly because they have consolidated their manufacturing plants around the world so that they are all operating on the same wavelength. They can jump right now and get small vehicles from Korea. They can get small vehicles from Europe. They can tap any one of their manufacturing and design bases around the world to bring in vehicles.
I noticed that you're saying that these vehicles would be brought in, not made here.
Well, you know, General Motors is a worldwide company. And while they're shutting plants here, they can very quick. What I'm talking about is response time. You know, you just can't design, engineer, and tool up a vehicle overnight to meet, quite frankly, the overnight demand of Americans. This is typical of us. When gas was a dollar a gallon, which, by the way, was just a couple years ago, people wanted big, giant vehicles, and they wanted them right now. This is an unprecedented time when fuel economy is the number one buying consideration, not design, not quality, not resale value. Fuel economy is number one, and people are insane. And GM can probably deliver those small cars, I would think, in very quick order by 2010, which is just around the corner. Meanwhile, they have a lot of cars right now that deliver 30 miles per gallon or more.
Their biggest problem is recovering now from the strikes that have shut down some of the factories that build those popular vehicles. So they have to get those back up and running.
Gene Jennings, editor of Automobile Magazine. We've been talking about GM's announcement today that it plans to shut down four plants that make big SUVs and trucks in response to rising gas prices. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you, Madeline.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Debt collection agencies may get more aggressive when they go after unpaid medical bills. The Wall Street Journal reports today some hospitals have started auctioning off their uncollected health care bills to the highest bidder. For an explanation of where we're going with this, we turn to Marketplace's Bob Moon. Bob, what's the significance of this for people who maybe are behind in their medical bills? How would they notice a difference?
Well, on the surface, this isn't much different from the way that debt collection agencies usually work, Alex. They buy the right to collect outstanding debts at a discount, and they get a share of the take. The difference here is that some of these hospitals have started to auction off their debt on a couple of online websites that have been developed just for this purpose, and that turns the debt collection firms into bidders. The hospital may get more money, but the flip side of that is that buying the debt can become more expensive for the collectors, and this arrangement has the collectors either buying the debt outright or providing a guarantee of payment to the hospitals for access to these unpaid bills. Well, consumer groups think this could end up meaning the debt collectors are going to have to be more aggressive in going after the people who owe this debt because these collectors are going to need to recoup their investment right up front.
Right. You know, there are consumer advocates and also healthcare advocates, many of them. What are they saying about this?
Well, for one thing, they say that once the bills get turned over to a collector, that separates the patient from possible financial assistance policies and other options that the hospitals might offer. We spoke a short time ago to Mark Rukavina. He's the executive director of the Boston-based Access Project, an advocacy group that's focused on medical debt.
Our advice to people who have medical bills that they're just struggling to pay is don't ignore them. You know, act promptly, whether you get a letter from the provider or a letter from a collection agency. We've just seen time and time again that people have been far more effective at working to resolve these bills and design repayment plans with providers than they have when the bills are held by other parties.
Consumer advocates say that even if a third party is involved, that doesn't stop you from contacting the medical provider directly to clarify exactly what you owe, for example.
You know, Bob, you mentioned that other businesses are doing this same kind of thing, but other businesses aren't hospitals. Isn't there a kind of PR danger here that the perception that they're cracking down on poor patients?
Yeah, that does, in fact, seem to be on their minds right now. Some of these hospitals say that they're being very, very cautious here and kind of testing the waters, if you will, with these debt collection sites. And in some cases, they're actually reserving the right to call these debts back from the collectors if they need to, especially if they deserve special consideration or the patient deserves special assistance, that sort of thing.
Thanks. Bob Moon of Public Radio's Daily Business Show Marketplace. It's Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brand. Although oil prices have actually dropped a little bit over the last 2 weeks, gas prices have not. And $4 a gallon, that's a reality in many U.S. cities.
How about the equivalent of $9 a gallon? That's what British motorists are paying. And like drivers here in this country, many are very unhappy about the price. Here's a little sample of opinion from London.
Basically, we will moan and groan and everything else, but when it comes actually to doing something about it, we let it be.
I mean, what, the price of fuel's gone up over a pound in not even a year?
Yeah, getting a bit on the ridiculous side.
Outrageous.
Not much we can do about it.
It's just a rip-off. It's going up about a penny every day.
I think the government should cut the rate of tax on fuel.
You know, if I had my fare going up a penny every day, I'd be a millionaire.
British motorists complaining about the high price of fuel in that country.
Here in the States, while consumers are worrying about prices, some lawmakers are trying to tackle global climate change. In Southern California, a lawmaker is pushing a plan that would reduce greenhouse gases and road congestion. Nate Berg reports.
At more than $4 a gallon, gas prices are already too high for many Angelenos.
But a new bill moving its way through the state legislature could push that price up another 9 cents. All that loose change would add up to create a county public transportation fund worth more than $400 million a year.
The status quo is not acceptable.
That's Mike Feuer, a Democrat in the California State Assembly. He represents Los Angeles and is the author of the bill.
No one would say that we can be sanguine about the impact of global warming. No one would say that LA status as the number one sort place for air pollution in the country ought to continue to be so. And no one would say that we have a muscular public transit infrastructure here in Los Angeles. The question is, what are we going to do about it?
What he wants to do is let LA's transit agency, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, bring his funding idea before the county's voters. The MTA could either ask voters to support the gas fee or an additional fee of up to $90 on their annual car registrations. The money it raises would fund public transit projects and programs aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. In a county with nearly 6 million registered drivers, getting enough voters behind the bill will be a challenge. But fewer thinks it can be done, and that now's the time to do it.
For the first time here in Los Angeles, there's a real openness to thinking in new ways about how we get from one place to another. I clearly think the time is right here, because of that awareness, to try to give voters these kinds of choices.
But for industries that rely on gasoline, a rise in price is a tough sell.
You're asking one segment to help another segment. I think it's just unfair.
Antoine Royster is on the board of directors of the Greater California Livery Association, which represents limousine drivers in California. Los Angeles is a major market for limos, and when gas prices rise, limo prices rise.
We have to pass on those additional fees to the client, bottom line. It's affecting not only us, but it's also affecting our clientele.
Americans pay some of the lowest taxes on gasoline in the world. And Feuer says taxpayers are going to have to play a bigger role in funding transit if it's ever going to improve. Much of the burden, he says, is going to have to fall on the driver. At this old service station in busy central Los Angeles, Autumn Mann and Rudolph Porter are filling up their tanks. Like every other driver question here, they are not happy about Feuer's proposal.
It just seems like we're already paying so much for gas.
I don't like the idea. I think gas is high enough. And I think that they need to find the money elsewhere.
For public transportation systems, finding the money elsewhere is already happening. They couldn't stay in operation without government and taxpayer money. But getting money directly from drivers is relatively new territory. And while it may make LA drivers uneasy, for bus riders like Chris Griffin...
I don't drive, so I think that's an awesome idea.
Griffin is riding the bus down LA's Wilshire Boulevard.
You know, I pay taxes on a lot of stuff that I don't use.
Feuer's bill was just approved by the California State Assembly. It will head next to the State Senate. For National Public Radio, I'm Nate Berg.
Average college graduates this spring will have about $20,000 of debt. Should they begin saving for retirement or pay down that debt? What about that government stimulus check you may have already received? Should you use it to pay off debt? Should you use it to pay off your car loan or save that money? Here to discuss your options for paying down debt is Day-to-Day's personal finance contributor, Michelle Singletary. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Okay, this is your age-old dilemma, one that maybe you've talked about a few times on this show. You're in debt. Should you pay off the debt first and then save, or save first and then pay off the debt?
The answer is both. And it's interesting, we could talk about this every single week and people still don't get this because so many people are in debt and they're so overwhelmed, they don't know what to do. But here's the thing, you got to do both. You've got to save and you have to pay down debt. And when I say save, I mean save for an emergency, save for your retirement. If you've got kids eventually going to college, save for their college fund, but you also got to pay down the debt. So if you've got a little bit of money, divide it by how many pots you need to, put a little bit towards savings and some to debt. Because the thing is, if you only throw it at the debt, if something happens, and something always happens, you'll end up going into more debt to cover that expense. So say your car breaks down, you have no savings, and you're trying to pay down a credit card debt. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to use that credit card. So you need to put something aside for the things in life that happen.
Okay, so you are a fresh out of college graduate. You get $1,200, let's say, in gift money for your graduation, and you have zero savings. What do you do?
You've got to save that money. Don't go buy out any clothes. Don't go out dinner with the other graduates. Put that money away. You're going to need it. Any of us who've ever had our first job understand what it's like to really be out there without help from mom and dad, without the cover of college. So you want to build at least a 3-month living expenses. Everything, rent, cable, car payment, especially those cell phone bills. You want to add all those up, multiply it times 3. That's how much you need to have an emergency fund. So you need every penny of that money.
Okay, so let's say you've done that. You have your 3 months emergency supply. Should you then use money to pay down a debt or student loans?
Well, you're not done saving for emergency just yet. I have talked to people about this, and I figured out, listen, you need an emergency fund and something else that I call a life happens fund. That's for the car repairs, dental work, you know, all the little things that you need to take care of. So you want to have 3 to 6 months living in an emergency fund and about $500 to $1,000 in the life happens fund to tide you over for those unplanned expenses.
Okay, so after you've done all that and you are a fresh new graduate, you also have student loans, you also have a car loan. Which one should you pay off first?
I would look at the terms for both and the interest rate. If both the car loan and the student loan debt are about the same interest rate, which it could be these days, I would go after the car loan first, because if you're under a certain income threshold, you can deduct some of that interest that you pay on that student loan debt. If you are above that threshold, which many college graduates wouldn't, I'd probably go after the student loan debt. But overall, just have a plan. If you've got an extra $200 a month, throw $100 at both to pay it down. And for those new graduates out there and those parents with the student loan debt, don't keep this debt around like it's a pet. So definitely get rid of that student loan debt as fast as you can.
Personal finance expert Michelle Singletary writes the Color of Money column for The Washington Post. Michelle, thank you.
You're welcome.
Back now with Day to Day. Titer is a one-man singing sensation from the Faroe Islands. These are islands clustered between Iceland and Norway, tucked up there in the North Atlantic. Our music critic Christian Bordahl happens to be from that area. He was born in Norway. And so Christian brought Titer into our studios here at NPR West to talk and play some songs off his new album, The Singer.
I'm in love with a girl I don't know.
Titer says the Faroe Islands are an idyllic place for kids to grow up.
Very small islands, actually. You can always sort of see the water wherever you are. And it's quite isolated from the rest of the world.
As he grew older, however, the isolation began to feel like confinement. And at age 17, he moved with his family to Denmark.
And it just seemed like a good idea at the time. I was a teenager, I was bored, and I wanted to play music and go somewhere else.
Though he no longer lives on the Faroes, Titer has maintained a close connection to his homeland. And on his new album, The Singer, he's harnessed some of the bleak iconoclasm and introspection that resides in those far-flung reaches of the Scandinavian soul.
You got sapphire eyes, and that's okay. I've seen that before, it's nothing new. You can look at me that way if you want, but don't let me fall in love with you.
The Singer is Titer's third English language album, and it was recorded on yet another picturesque Scandinavian island called Gotland, where he even found some local musicians to add to the mix.
We found out that there was a great brass band in Gotland, and then we just set up a girls' choir. We found also this musician that lived on Gotland. That's amazing. He'd done a lot of the music for the Pippi Longstockings. You know, because that was all shot on Gotland. All those TV series, the Pippi Longstockings.
In Ingmar Bergman also lived on a tiny island off the northern tip of Gotland for much of his life and shot some of his movies there. And a melancholic, Bergman-like fascination with relationships and the human condition pervades the stories on The Singer.
It's still the same. Nothing has changed. We still drink the same water. It's still the same. Nothing has changed. We still drink the same water.
When he joined me in the studio at NPR West, Titor played the title track from his new record. With its mixture of direct storytelling, subtle humor, and musical minimalism, the song sets the tone for the rest of the album.
I always had the voice, and now I am a singer. The audience grows silent when I open up my mouth. I sing about my loneliness, and in return they thank me. I'd never meant to be singer, but I'm slowly getting used to the idea.
On his new album, Titor channels a Scandinavian vibe into slow, often dark songs that can feel more like musical fragments because of their sparse instrumentation and lack of traditional pop song structure. But if you're willing to go with him to that quiet, sometimes beautiful, sometimes harsh, contemplative place, he'll make it worth your effort. Oh, and he has managed to squeeze in this one light, upbeat pop number called
Catherine the Waitress.
For NPR News, this is Christian Bordahl.
If you only knew where my mind is.
That's Titor. His latest CD is called The Singer, and to hear the songs he played live in our studio, go to npr.org/music. Be flexible.
Be prepared.
Say goodbye.
In the spring of the year, when college grads go off to work, or maybe one more summer off, they receive a lot of advice, the centerpiece, of course, the commencement address.
We wondered if people actually remember that advice that they receive 5, 10, or 25 years after they graduate, or even if they remember who the speaker was.
So producer Ki Min Sung went to the Westwood area of Los Angeles to find out.
Do you remember who your graduation speaker was?
Yeah, the speaker of my graduation was... I don't recall the name.
Yeah, A. Whitney Griswold. His advice I remember, too, because I thought it was so trite. He said, what we need is a dynamic approach to broad general principles.
Walter Cronkite College.
What did he say?
It was hard to tell because it was in a football stadium that held probably about 60,000, 70,000 people, and it was about 90 degrees.
I don't remember his name, but he was head of IBM.
What do you remember about the speech?
It was mostly about going for your dreams, and he was relating it to doves somehow.
I remember him using all these baseball metaphors about the excellence of students at Brown. It was like baseball, and we were virtuous, and we were excellent.
The last degrees I got were like a combined BS and MD at New York University Medical School in 1947.
And do you remember who your graduation speaker was in 1947?
Should I be expected to?
If they were dynamic, you would.
No, as a matter of fact, I skipped town before the graduation ceremony. You know, it wasn't that important to me that I felt I wanted to stick around and have some old man or lady tell us what life's supposed to be about. Okay?
Stately Grace of Day to Day, a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand.